Yeah, yeah, I went to Trollen last night. I didn't see you there.
What?
It's a bit far from me.
I know.
So I get ready to go, and then about, 9:30, 9 o'clock rolls around, I'm like, ah.
I know. I have that same feeling sometimes. You just kind of don't know what you don't know. And then you get ready to get to go. And
yeah. When I was buying the umbrella, I went into Duane Reade. I never looked at Newsweek or Time Magazine. It's crap. But I saw this thing in Time Magazine on decline in America and stuff. And it's by a guy named David Frum. I think he's formerly conservative. I think he went over to the liberal side. And I think he might be gay. I'm not sure. But he's an essayist. Right. And I stood there, I read it, and finally I just bought it because what I liked about it so much was it was pessimistic. It didn't end on some note like, oh, we'll get through this, we're America. It ended on a pessimist, on an ambiguous note. And we're supposed
you like
to,
that.
You can start recording now.
I am.
You are?
Yeah, sure.
Is it picking me up?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Sure.
So we're on such a trip where we're not supposed to complain. Complainers are not, there's some truth to that, but obviously it goes too far, I think, because the American people have a lot of reason to complain. We're also, supposed to be really optimistic about everything. One thing he pointed out that was very interesting was, even within the elite, the top 1% of wealth versus the top 1/100th of percent of wealth, that's the top, say, 3 million people versus the top 30,000 people. The top 30,000 people who all have probably around $100 million in net worth or more, maybe a little bit less than that, the top 30,000 people are pulling way ahead of the top 3 million people, just like the top 3 million people are holding their own against the bottom 99%. The top 1/100th of a percent is just, it's almost as if all this money from all this wealth stagnation, all these years, and I mean, the most amazing statistic came out 3 months ago that said the median family's net worth since 2007, in a mere 5 years, the median, that's half of all of them are wealthier, half of them all are poorer, has dropped by 38%. It's gone down from about $125,000 to about $75,000. The median, so that means people, the average, the middle family, the bottom quarter has negative net worth. They're in debt. They owe more than they own. The next quarter up has a little bit, and then the quarter above that, the next to the highest quarter has a little bit more. But the point is, half the family right in the middle has lost 40% of its wealth that it strived for in 5 years, and no one's even out on the streets. In the 30s, there'd be huge demonstrations. I don't know if it's because people are so manipulated by the media that they're isolated, they don't know how to organize, or if it's because people are taken care of better now by the government. There's food stamps, so there's no need for soup kitchens. People can it's hard to say what the reasons are, but there's been a massive wipeout of wealth. And it's all accrued to the top 1/100th of 1%. There's been a $5 trillion drainage of wealth in the last 10 years from the bottom 99.99%. And there's no way to trace it exactly, but it's like a hydraulic, like a water press. It goes down in one area by $5 trillion, and in this very small, rarefied area, it goes up by $5 trillion.
Well, yesterday they had a very interesting revealing article. They did this whole investigation, the feds, on Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
And they found them innocent.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought to myself, now you have to understand that the last Fed guy was Gettner?
The last blow was Greenspan.
No, but after him.
Oh, you're thinking Geithner. He's Secretary of the Treasury.
Right, Secretary. Well, he's from the Fed.
Right.
And he was from.
Yeah,
Goldman
there's
Sachs.
They're so, all so, so tied in. Like, for example, on this MF Global deal where all this money disappeared under Corzine, the trustee who's been chosen, you know, I'm not exactly right, but it was from a law firm that Corzine did. Everyone is related in one way or another. They're all washing each other's hands.
So all I'm saying, my theory is this. You know, the middle class was creeping up higher and higher, especially due to the internet
and computers, and technological
and that's part
productivity
of,
increases.
Yeah, but they're not really part of the aristocracy.
No,
they're just kids mostly or young people who have stumbled onto
who's
something.
That. You're talking
the,
about
the internet bubble.
Oh, you're not talking about the middle class in America.
No, but what I'm talking about. So they actually. The idea where I'm going is this, and see, let me know what you think. Is that maybe we were getting too close to the aristocracy.
Yeah.
We were getting too high up the ladder, and we were joining, we were trying to join the club. We were, you know, it's kind of like the French Revolution.
We were
storming the Bastille.
Right,
the Bastille was the aristocracy,
right.
Because, you know, there's two types of prison. There's a prison that keeps you in and the prison that keeps you out.
Yeah, that's true.
So if you go to these rich neighborhoods, they have gated communities.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm wondering if maybe there was some of that, and what your thoughts on that are.
Well, you know, it's like they... The very top protects itself. They're all related. There's an axis, let's say, between Boston, New York, and Washington, to simplify. Boston representing Harvard, but could represent any other elite school in any other city. It doesn't have to be Harvard. It could be Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, Columbia, New York, or whatever. But let's call it Boston for simplicity's sake. And then there's New York, which is Wall Street. And then there's Washington, which are the policymakers in Washington. So the people from Boston are the ones who are often rationalizing intellectually what the policymakers do, giving them policy papers to do it. Then they often get hired as consultants while they're professors by big companies that benefit from these policies. Not all regulations are anti-business. A lot of regulations inevitably end up being pro-business. And these are policies that are written by policymakers.
Right, for
and they're written, rationalized by people in academia who rationalize it one way or another. And then these people in academia get jobs as highly priced consultants with big corporations or consulting at trials, let's say, where they're expert witnesses for tens of thousands of dollars, you know, a day even. And so academia benefits, they also benefit because some of them become lobbyists for a while, and lobbyists make huge amounts of money because one little change in the tax law can save a group billions of dollars. So they're very well compensated. So what I'm talking about, the academics, either they can be consultants, they can be lobbyists, they can go into government, come back out with more knowledge and be consultants for the area of the government they were in. So top academia is in it and getting richer and richer. You never had academics get this wealthy because of these things before. Also, ex-politicians like Clinton are getting wealthier and wealthier. It's expected. It's normal now. Like Tony Blair and Clinton, when they're done, they take consulting gigs. Like Blair and Clinton were both consultants for MF Global that Corzine was on. They're making tens of thousands of dollars a month as consultants for Wall Street firms. So now ex-presidents, even if they give half of their money away to a foundation, become multi-millionaires. The way to get rich is to go into politics. Now, Harry Truman never did anything like this, it was unheard of. These guys retire from politics and they automatically become rich. They give speeches for, Obama will give speeches for $100,000 a crack, and he'll sit on corporate boards, or he'll be a consultant, or a senator will be a lobbyist, and in an area that he was involved in the Senate, that he was a committee member of, maybe transportation, so he'd be a lobbyist for the auto industry, whatever, make huge sums of money. So you've got politicians who make money and have power, and they protect the the top 0.01% with regulations like taking down, deregulating certain things that benefit the top, and regulating certain things that invariably benefit the top. So you got the Washington axis, you got the Boston axis of academics, like I just described, you benefit. And then you got the really rich people in New York on Wall Street who benefit from all of this, because the rules, even if they're made, regulations to hem their behavior and are not enforced. They're not enforced by Washington, and these people who don't enforce the rules end up going to work for these companies later on, making huge amounts of money. So the whole thing is a very small group of people scratching each other's back. We're talking about maybe 100,000 people in a country of 300 million.
Well, but so I had a conversation with Abramoff.
Yeah.
Who got spent some time in jail as a lobbyist because he was manipulated.
That's interesting.
And now he has a radio program.
So is he trying to uncover the truth?
Right,
somehow?
That's what he's doing, because he knows the game.
Yeah.
And so now he's exposing it. And so he gave a talk at a conference that I gave a talk at.
I mean, I've always found him to be an asshole. But
that's what he said.
If he's coming around, and if he's trying to be a man of truth, and if he's trying to expose it, I say all honor to him.
Yeah, no, he's really, he's very interesting. I talked to him a little bit.
What is the gist of what he's saying? Obviously, he's saying lobbyists. He was a lobbyist.
He's just saying how corrupt the system is.
Yeah, terribly corrupt.
And how... You know, who knows better than
I haven't even mentioned campaign donations from the super PACs.
The
small donor is falling by the wayside. There's fewer and fewer small donors. They figure, what's the point?
Right.
Why can't you compete with the super PACs? And it's just unbelievably corrupt. Everything is legalized corruption.
So I wrote when the meltdown of Humpty Dumpty fell off the Wall Street wall.
Right, Lehman Brothers. And
all these guys.
Yeah.
I wrote in my Facebook, I said, the USSR imploded because of cronyism.
Yes.
You know, the apparatus.
That's a good analogy.
The USA
is doing the same thing.
It's imploding.
That's a
of
good
crime.
Analogy. I think that's a very original, a very good thought. Very good analogy. And what's everyone doing? They tell you to go out and be an entrepreneur, like if you can't get a job. How's someone supposed to be an entrepreneur to compete against huge corporations with multi-billion dollar marketing budgets and R&D budgets? It's not like 50, 60 years ago when someone could start a small business and corporations were not as disproportionately as large a part of the economy that could stomp out the small businessman. And everyone's like, also, people, there's massive underemployment. They don't count it in employment. The number of people who aren't working between a given age, say 45 to 64, men, has gone way, way up. People aren't working. People can't find jobs. Wages have been stagnant for 30 or 40 years. And meanwhile, the creme de la creme has gotten richer than ever. And not necessarily very patriotic either. I don't think a lot of them care much about the country. They go off on yachts to the south of France with their compatriots. And they party. And some of them even renounce their citizenship. And how much do you take people like the Koch brothers, who are involved in chemical production and in other things that have an impact on the environment, funding studies, funding academics who are dissidents? Hardly any academics reject human role in global warming now in their field. Hardly any academics reject that, but they will fund the ones that reject it. And we continue on with this worst drought in American history, average temperature 4.3 degrees above normal, and the warmest July in recorded American history. And what are we told? We're told to produce more. Everyone's got to produce more so we can buy more. But we don't need anything more. You can go into a Goodwill store and buy a shirt for $2. The only thing we're lacking is a decent medical system, healthcare system. But as far as food goes, there's 49.3 million people on food stamps. Food is taken care of. Clothing is taken care of. Shelter is basically taken care of. People have places to sleep if they have to. And healthcare could be taken care of. So what is the point of all this massive production machine? We're producing things we don't need, and people don't have money to buy the things that are being produced by the small elite that owns the factories. You know, what's so interesting is that up until the 70s, wages were rising steadily. Salaries were rising steadily, and then came a long stagnation, and in fact, wages and salaries have slipped in the last 10 years. But what happened in the 70s, instead of getting a rise in wages, what the worker got, basically, was a credit card and better, easier term mortgages. So they felt like their living standards were going up because they were borrowing on the future. They had credit cards that they borrowed more and more, went deeper and deeper into debt, and they had bigger and bigger houses that they didn't necessarily need, and they had cheap mortgages on them, and they went deeper and deeper into debt. But their real salary, real income was stagnant or even declining. It was just a charade. It looked like their living standards was going up. Meanwhile, the entities that supplies the credit cards and the mortgages were making a fortune in fees and making a fortune and profits, and now the shit has hit the fan. There's so much debt that people can't pay it off, and they're crumbling. They're crumbling under the debt, and it's not just individuals. It's every level of government: state, county, local, federal. Every area, in fact, except corporations, which now have a record amount of cash readily at hand. Big corporations.
So, I was involved in a film called "In Debt We Trust" by Danny Schechter that showed around, and which was quite interesting because he really was saying about how we believe it's a takeoff on God we trust, or in our country we trust.
Right.
But actually, what he's really saying is the conspiracy of debt.
Right. Yeah. There's a very famous poem. He was a right winger, by the way. He was a racist, anti-Semite, but he was a brilliant poet. And later on, he disavowed his views. Ezra Pound, I believe.
Yeah,
Ezra Pound.
Right.
And he has a famous poem called Usura, which means usury.
Mm-hmm.
And what a burden it puts on lives. And yeah, go ahead. So go ahead.
Do you know it? No, I'm just saying if you know it.
No, I don't know the poem, but I didn't memorize it. It's a great poem. It's in his cantos. But go ahead. So
the interesting thing is the next film that Danny Schechter did was called Plunder, the Crime of the Century.
Yeah.
About the conspiracy of how a few people could come together and play the stock market.
Right.
Played against itself.
Right.
That's what they were bidding for failure.
Look, I am a cat. I do live in the capitalist world, so I'm no saint. Right. I'm a capitalist, and I grew up believing that basically the stock market. When I say capitalist, I don't mean I believe in it so much as that I practice it. Unfortunately, I'm actually a bit of a hypocrite. It's very hard not to be in this society. I try to lead a simple life. I try not to put a big impact on the environment. I try, as reasonably possible and lead a fairly ascetic life. But anyway, but that's beside the point. My point, the stock market, I always have been involved in for a number of years, many years. I used to basically believe it was a level playing field. Basically, you know, people would always come along and say, oh, it's a setup, it's crooked, you can't win in it, blah, blah, blah. And I basically thought they were fairly ignorant cynics. And now I'm starting to believe that that's not necessarily the case, especially in recent years, especially with new modes of technology that allow for the manipulation of the market and uneven reception of data. Some entities can get a lot more data than other entities. If you get a lot more data, like on who's buying what, who owns what, because you have an overview of the internet. It used to be like the wealthiest guy or the most powerful guy in the community was the feudal lord who had the highest house, the hill, the highest hill. His house was on the highest hill. Now, the equivalent of that is the person who is sitting on the highest hill of data or information and is able to look at all these different things that are supposedly private. We're losing all of our privacy and will gain an unfair benefit in the stock market because they're able to look at this. Or not necessarily just that, manipulation of the stock market by these high-frequency traders. There's so many examples. A lack of true enforcement, selective enforcement. Things like I mentioned before, MF Global, $1.3 billion. Disappearing into the clear blue sky. So much, so few people prosecuted. Meanwhile, you have 3 million people in jail in America, the majority of them for drug-related crimes, whereas the biggest thieves and crooks who have stolen billions of dollars are out on their boats near the Hamptons. And I'm not saying anything new.
Well, it's interesting. I lived in Paris and in France, and I had a girlfriend there, and she alerted me to something very interesting, and we wouldn't know necessarily. She said, you know, hundreds of years ago, the tallest buildings were the religious buildings, the church. Mm-hmm. And then in the last 100 years, the tallest buildings became the mayor's, the government office.
So it's gone from, it went from church to government.
Government. And now, today, the tallest buildings are corporations.
There's
the religion that we...
That's a very insightful, also a very original comment. We've gone from religion to government to the bank skyscraper or the corporate skyscraper being the tallest building.
Yeah.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not saying socialism in a classic sense is the answer. I don't have that much faith in the government collecting all this money and redistributing it. The government is incredibly inefficient and prone to corruption. There's got to be other ways. There's got to be a whole new way of looking at things, like we're damaging ourselves ecologically in this inane effort to keep growing for the sake of growth. And we're damaging ourselves emotionally. People, social isolation, guys like Putnam at Harvard have shown, is at an all-time high. The number of people the average person can confide in is much lower than, say they can confide in, is much lower than it was 30 years ago. People are socially isolated. I say this from a conservative almost standpoint, that like there was this social scientist, Christopher Lash, who is mainly a Marxist, but he had a conservative side to him. I say this also for what he said. There's a breakdown of the extended family, which conservatives bemoan, and I agree with that 100%. And there's a breakdown of the church, even if you don't believe in the church. The fact that so fewer people are involved in community things like the church, there's a breakdown, and there's a huge increase in social isolation. So what do we have left? We have social isolation. We have people who are making less money than they did 30 years ago. People who are underemployed. And we have some meaningless race to keep the economy growing for the sake of a very, very small elite. And like I said before, the real problem is underconsumption in a way. The vast masses of people who are paid to make things no longer have the money to buy the things they make. They've gone out on credit cards to buy the things they make. They've strung out on debt to buy the things they make. But finally, there's not enough. So there's all this ability to produce things, but there's not enough demand to satiate the need to sell what's produced.
It's interesting because years ago when everybody was talking about outsourcing, I said, well, you know, this is brilliant. There's going to come a point in time where they're going to outsource everything. Nobody's going to have jobs, and they're going to try and sell it back to the first world.
Well, that, in a sense, like I said before, I was saying about underconsumption, there's been, and when we were talking a few months ago about it, there's been certain things that have kept the game going a lot longer than was supposed. And perhaps this isn't the end of the game. There's technological innovations. We may be witnessing a breakthrough in solar right now that's obedient, in a sense, to Moore's law, that everything becomes less expensive by double over a very short period of time, if we have a real breakthrough in solar, not only does that have great implications for the world economy, we've had ecology, we've had breakthrough, and if it continues, but if you project it out about 10 or 12 years, energy could be virtually free. So maybe the system will get bailed out by technology, by technological production. We'll see.
So on that same vein, there were a lot of inventions over the years that could have revolutionized a combustion engine.
Right.
That the car manufacturers bored of.
Right. It's amazing that we've been on the moon for 40 years and we can't figure out alternatives. Stinky, filthy farts emitted by automobiles.
But here, so I have to be an inventor. So I took an invention that I had of a product to the company that made the base product.
Yeah.
Grace Chemical. And I was talking with the head of their R&D, and he said, well, write me up, you know, what you think about it, you know, how we can implement it. I talked to him later. He said, you know, this is brilliant. The only problem is we'll have to change everything we're doing.
That makes you wonder about those, when you hear stories about those companies that were shown electric engines and then they bought the patent and they ditched it.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
So, you know, who knows? So, you know, I remember going to Occupy Wall Street and I met an advertising exec. And he said, you know, he said he feels schizophrenic because on one hand, he's getting people to buy stuff they don't really need or want. On the other hand, he's frustrated with the system. And he's going to, well, I can understand that. Nobody's pure. It's not as simple as it used to be.
You have your own contradictions going on.
Right, absolutely.
You know, being involved in the stock market, investing in...
Absolutely, in companies that are far from pure.
Right. How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel like if I have a knack for doing something like this and I've benefited from it and I'm able to support my family for doing it, then I have to do it. That's just the way, because it's a zero-sum game. If I don't do it and I'm St. Francis of Assisi, someone else will do it in my stead. On the other hand, like I say, I try to live a simple, relatively ascetic life, and I'm not saying I'm Gandhi by any means, but I think comparatively I'm not ashamed of how I live.
So I have this question that I have asked people on for Who's Wearing the Emperor's New Clothes, a documentary I've been doing, among other things, on the media and on TV. And so one of the questions I ask is, what do you think the last person on the planet would say?
That's a great question. That's like asking someone, what will be your last sentence? What will the last person on the planet say? That's a really... I can't answer that question. I can only say I like that question.
So a couple of my thoughts on that. I originally thought the last person on the planet would say I was just following orders.
The classic line.
And then I thought, well, maybe he said, yeah, I had to pay my mortgage.
Very relevant to what we're talking about. Yeah, a guy's got to make a living, right, more or less. Right.
Even though he's just blown up the whole future.
Right.
But he would just either following orders
or paying. Those are the two rationales. I was just following orders, or I was just trying to take care of myself.
Now, another friend of mine was telling me a story that he was from Bulgaria. No, he was from Greece. And I don't know if it's real or not, but he said that what they realized in the Greek and the Turkish war was that you can't inhabit a country, its land, with the people on it. You have to dislodge the people.
Ethnic cleansing.
Right. So you have to kill them all. So he planted bombs all over this town. This is the story.
Yeah.
We're going to blow up the town. Yeah, he's the guy who's got to push the lever.
He's the guy who ultimately has to kill the people. He's the trigger puller.
There's a general standing next to him with a gun to his head.
Right.
And it's the same thing happened during the Nazis, during the concentration camps.
I'll give you an example from my mother. I'll tell you in a minute.
Mm-hmm. Let me finish this. Because the interesting thing was, what happens was some of the Germans couldn't imagine doing this.
Yeah, right.
So what did they do? They sent them on the other side. They sent the, you know, the German soldiers who were going to shoot the the innocent whoever they were.
You know, fellow German soldiers.
No, they could have been just gypsies, whatever, or Jews or other human beings, and they just couldn't.
Right.
And so they put them on. They said, okay, well, that's fine. Just go on the other side.
Yeah.
And we'll shoot you.
That's right.
So,
well, my mother, you know, she was, you know, the Camp Schindler's List was Plaszów, which is outside of Krakow. She was in there. And then afterwards, for about 3 months towards the end of the war, right before it was, quote, liberated, unquote, she was in Auschwitz from October of 44 to January of 45. And then she was taken on a death march around Germany and until about beginning of May of 45 when the war ended. But anyway, in Plaszów, she had a friend, she said was an attractive kind of blondish girl, Jewish girl, woman, young woman, who had a kind of romance. Maybe it was just a flirtation, because there was a law against Germans sleeping with Jews. They could be punished. It was called Rassenschande. They could be punished with death. They weren't supposed to. So actually, that helped prevent probably a lot of rapes. Not all of them, but it probably did. Anyway, there was some kind. She said that the guy, the soldier, she called him, quote, somewhat liberal, unquote, which means he probably wasn't a maniacal killer, and he was in the SS, and he had a little flirtation going. I don't know if it was consummated with this Jewish girl, and his superiors found out about it, and they gave him a gun, and they lined up all the inmates, and they got the girl out of the line, and they told him, and they held a gun to his head, and they said, you have to shoot the girl, and he did shoot the girl. So, but within 1 second of that shot, they shot him.
Uh-huh, because they knew he would shoot him.
No, yeah. As soon as he shot the girl, they were going to punish him anyway.
Right.
And they shot him.
And was she watching this, or did she just heard
my
this?
Mother? Yeah. My mother watched him.
Now, let me ask you a question. When did your mother tell you these stories?
Over the course of time, you know, since I've been a kid. She didn't tell me a lot, and I didn't ask a lot. I have tapes, too, of her, you know. And her mother also, which is very unusual. They both survived. And they were from Krakow, and like she had a brother who had to dig his own ditch, and was shot with a group of people. And you know, it's all the Holocaust horror stories.
My cousin did the Warsaw Ghetto film for the BBC.
Really?
Yeah, he found General Jürgen Stroop's archives, which were commissioned by Himmler.
Yeah.
To be the only one to create an art to film it.
Yeah. Well, I would love to see that. Unfortunately, for me, it's very close to home.
Right.
But, you know, it's. But yeah, I would love to see. It's amazing that there's still a few people who were in the uprising who are still alive.
Well, my cousin actually escaped the Warsaw Ghetto the first time, came to London during the war, and told people what was going on in London, but nobody believed him.
That's a famous story.
Well, this,
I mean, he's a famous guy. That's a well-known story that someone.
Oh, I've never heard anybody.
Yeah,
knew
it's
about
a well-known story.
Oh, that's interesting, because I wrote a script and a treatment called Dying to Live.
Mm-hmm. So you had family over in Europe
that didn't make it over. Yeah, my mother was born in Poland. And so we lost a lot of family.
Sure.
She came before.
Where were you born?
I was born in Langley Field, Virginia, during the war.
Oh, Langley. That's where the CIA is.
That's where the CIA is now, but before...
Was your dad in the... SS or whatever it was?
My father was actually, he just loved people. So what he did was it got him to be the officers' club, where they have the recreational things for the officers.
Right.
So, and he got called up four or five times, my mother says, to go overseas. And every time they held them back, because they loved my father. You know, yeah. He made all these games and all these things, and he had all this energy, and he was just this...
Wow.
He organized all the things. They just said, we can't lose
Charlie. Wow. That's very nice. He must have been a fun guy.
Yeah, it's the last day. He finally gets called up, and they call him more often.
that's lucky. Let's try to get a coffee here.
But the interesting thing with my cousin was that we hadn't heard from him for many years. He came to the house a few times. It was kind of as somebody who gave me his archives and his... He died in a council house, which was like an SRO, single room occupancy, in London. Spread out on his archives. The archives, which included the General...
Do you have the archives? Excuse me. When you get a chance.
When it started to smell. So the constable came in and they saw his body embracing all of his archives. And they looked and said, this must be important. And the guy sees this postcard on the floor to a guy named, slips my mind his name right now, but he's a big guy in the Jewish world in London. And he calls him up and says, I don't know, we got this archive.
Excuse me, George, 1 second. Let me get this guy's... Excuse me, sir. I just want a coffee.
And he comes over and he sees my cousin, you know, sees the archive, and he says, let's put this in a garage, padlock the garage until it goes through probate, basically. Right.
So why it
turns out, there was my aunt's, his mother's... Okay.
I just want a coffee, please.
Coffee? And I'll have a tea. A peppermint tea with honey, please.
You know what? Give me a peppermint tea, too, please. Thanks. It's better. I don't need all the caffeine.
Right. And what was interesting was that in this archive was also a whole bunch of things that I have, including I wound up having the film, a 16mm film, and some other films that somebody else did of his... Vivo has the film. It's a well-known film, but it was done by...
Yeah, I've heard about it.
The war
surrogate.
And it was said that every piece of a photo, every book that was done about the Jewish circumstances and the Jewish the Warsaw ghetto had one of the photos that he had found. Because what he did was he went back after World War II, and got back into the camp. And so here he is crazy. He's going back into the camp with a camera to take photos.
That sounds like you're related to a person in a very famous story, because that's a very well-known story.
Really?
I don't know about the photo. I've never heard that one. But I've heard about the people who got out of Poland and went to London and tried to, you know, say what was going on. People who, they let some people out who were fighting the Germans from the Warsaw Ghetto to escape. There was like maybe a limited number who could get out to tell the world. I don't quite remember the story, but some of them went to London.
Well, and they didn't believe. My cousin actually also testified supposedly at the Nuremberg trial.
Wow. We should turn it off for a minute.
Okay.
Since we're not talking about the economy.
What?
Since we're not talking about this, but like...
Okay,
I've got like 15 minutes, but go ahead. Keep going. I'm fascinated by your story. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay, I didn't realize you had that time.
Well, we can meet again in a few days.
My cousin... And I've written a treatment and a script for this called Dying to Live, as I mentioned.
How old was your cousin when he died? Late 60s?
Yeah, probably. He had cancer. He was a Dante-esque character. He used to go to the... That's how he described
it. Did you visit him in London ever?
No. I went to London in 1989 the first time. And then I was in London, and I made a couple of calls to a woman. And within an hour, I got all the information I needed. And the next day, I was meeting him. And we hadn't heard from him in 10 years.
Underwear, right?
And I have the archives that he gave me, of my family stuff. He did. My cousin turned out about $750,000 that he donated to Yad Vashem. And this guy, Felix Sharp, is his name, was the Yad Vashem representative. And my cousin would buy and go to the auctions to see what Jewish art was there, and then he would buy it, or somehow, nobody ever thought he had any money, but he came to the family, and he was an interesting guy. He was kind of, and he was on David Susskind about 5 times.
Oh, really?
So he was this character, and one of the pieces is he was caught in a bombing in London.
Oh, the Blitz.
The story is that somebody, he was buried alive, and somebody saw a little gold chain in his buried, so this guy comes and pulls on it.
It's a good reason to wear gold.
Right, yeah. And my cousin grabs his hand, or grabs it, won't let him take it.
And
rubble and stones and buildings. Left for dead.
I already put you on.
So it's just kind of an interesting story. I'll send you the treatment if you like.
Yeah. No, I would like. I'd like to see. Yeah, that's good too. But I'd also like to see some of the actual documents.
Oh yeah, I have it in 16mm.
Wow.
And I know it's in VHS and in DVD. He gave all this money to the Yad Vashem. So I've talked to people who did the fundraising for the Holocaust Museum in Washington. Is a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And nobody could find it. They said, Felix said they dedicated a room to my cousin, but nobody can find it there. So it's $750,000 in the 1980s is worth $3 or $4 million.
That's what's his last name?
His name is Benyek Berenfuss.
Berenfuss.
Right, or Alexander Berenfuss.
So now, just more on a more recent note, what was going on at Cholent last
night? Cholent was, Danny Leifer gave a talk on the ethics of eating animals, and animal ethics, how we treat animals.
I think that's great.
Which was interesting. She had an agenda, but
what's her first name?
Danny. That's Lori Leifer and Danny.
Oh, yeah,
Leifer
girls.
Leifer girls. Yeah, and they're great. They're just, they weren't born into this religious, Hasidic, observant community.
Right.
But somehow they're both kind of in it. And where is it happening? It happens in the synagogue that I was in the womb.
Oh, you're kidding. That place on Borough Park is...
Right. It's a synagogue.
Your parents?
My grandfather's synagogue that my mother went to. And
that's a remarkable coincidence. It's remarkable.
So it's just kind of a funny thing. So I'm actually trying to go tonight. I'm trying to support Isaac on his... because,
he wrote something about a ship cruise or something.
Yeah, that's on Monday. I'm planning to go
to
that.
Maybe I'll go to that.
Yeah, tonight they're having a Seder, but usually the Seder is during the summer.
You mean they're having a service at that shul?
Yeah. It's something that they have a service, but it's more just the dinner after.
What about how was turnout last night? I'm sure it was good.
It was better than I expected. But we had some amazing talks, including yours, but I mean, that are up there.
Nice.
But to me, What I'm trying to do in this is I'm doing this series called Observing the Observant,
right?
Which is a
catchy title.
We're exploring doing a number of different things, but it's a kind of a non-linear story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
You know, as is the story about Andy Dixon, ex-con with convictions.
Right.
Now, is that you know, who I've met in this diner many times, in the Chelsea diner. One of the things we were going to talk about was that as well. You know, Andy Dixon.
Oh yeah.
Spent time, 27 years of an illegal life without
that,
parole.
That's amazing.
With James Earl Ray.
I know, it's incredible.
You got a little sense of him and what?
I saw the tapes, but I tell you, what time is it now?
Oh. Okay, it's now 2:45.
I should get going pretty quickly.
Really?
I'm sorry, I've got a lot to do, but we could meet again. We could stay in touch.
Yeah. What time do you have to leave?
Like in 5 minutes.
Like in 5 minutes.
But tell me about it. Yeah.
So Andy's going to talk. He's going to, at the end of the month, there's a big conference on criminal reform and criminals.
Yeah.
An organization called CURE, which is something by and for, and they're having this big conference in Washington that Andy's going to and I'm going to as well. But Andy gave a great talk on plea bargaining. Interesting thing about plea bargaining is that 98% of all plea things involve plea bargaining because of the manipulation, and they get you to sign things, and all sorts of intimidation goes along. But what he's saying is that if people didn't do plea bargaining, it would bring the system down so that they would if you went to trial, it would create a whole...
There's not enough... Right. I mean, there's not enough courtrooms and judges.
And you have to send somebody to trial within a certain period of time.
Yeah, there'd be such a clogged system that people wouldn't go to trial for years and years.
Right. They have to take you to trial on...
They wouldn't go to trial because it would go past the statute of limitations.
But as you were saying, most of the prison things are drug-related anyway.
Yeah.
And that's that supports the system. But the thing with Andy is he also is the third of four generations to be incarcerated. And one of the things we're trying to do is break kids out of prison before they get in.
Right.
Because that whole generational incarceration thing is that, so a lot of the snowball, like my daughter's husband's brother, is in jail now.
Mm.
Went for some stupid thing.
Brother. Yeah.
Well, so now she's caught up into this whole situation.
Insane.
And she's afraid of
destroys
the kids are going to school. Because Andy, when he went to school, he said, listen, the teachers were saying, your grandfather went to prison, your father went to prison, you're going to go to prison. Why should we waste our time on you? And that's generational incarceration.
And
the whole system. So you have to ask, same thing with what you were talking about earlier about the economy and about the whole insanity. I mean, what does that say about our society?
It's insane. There's a prison industrial system. There's a military industrial system. They're both crazy.
But who benefits? There's a reason. I always wonder, and I look at these things, especially when they announce something groundbreaking, I look on the other side. I say, what are they hiding? Because, they position things.
It's horrible.
It's kind of like they announce things on Friday. What do they announce on Friday? Because they figure people will get by Monday.
This is something that a lot of even conservatives and leftists can agree on. There's certain government intrusiveness that is just absolutely
horrifying. Now, I should say, I'm not
horrifying.
Political. I'm not a political, because as a document, I'm a listener. I can't have a position.
Right.
I listen, but I try and avoid having a position on things, so this way I can listen.
Right.
Because a good talker is a better listener.
Well, that's true. I think that's true. Shit.
So you're putting your coat on?
No, I don't want to be rude. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm like short on time. I have obligations.
Well, we got rained out there for a while.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question. I'm going to be talking with Andy later. Is there any interest, do you think, on moving some of this stuff forward with Andy? Is that something?
Well, I constantly get asked, like,
No, I'm just wondering.
Financials. I really wouldn't commit myself to anything of a financial nature.
Yeah, it's not for me. It's just, you know, I'm just trying to.
Maybe I can help find foundations.
Mm-hmm.
I know a little about that.
Uh-huh.
But I just came back from something where it's pretty constant.
Toxic?
It's constant. I'm turn off the...
Okay.
Right.
So.
No, that's okay. I'll just walk with it like that.
Further.
We have two teas. Two teas. Two peppermint teas. Pardon? Oh, right. Yeah, thank you.
You just bought that umbrella.
We're enjoying it.
Yeah, it's for a documentary called a couple of things. One's called Diner Chats.
.com.
Take care. All right. Take care.
I wish one day you'd come over. I have a guy at my house.